I mean, we're not asking for Taj Mahals. We're not asking for expensive things. We're asking for basic services.
Lawmakers work to bring transportation infrastructure to rural Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 1st of October. Good evening, I'm Laurie Townsend. Also tonight, scientists investigate why 130 young walrus died recently on the North Shore.
If we had the sea ice in the Chukchi Sea that we would normally have had this time of year, those calves would probably still be alive today.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to Gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world. And by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com.
Healthcare for children is rising in importance for next year's legislative session. Bills that would increase participation in the Denali Kid Care program have new support. Sharon Lehow is Governor Parnell's spokeswoman.
The governor recognizes that many people have trouble affording health care, and Governor Parnell would support expanding Denali Kid Care eligibility limits to 200%. Anything above that level, he would favor copays. Some form of copays.
A bill passed the Senate last year that would raise the cap on families that could get complete medical care, primarily for children, from a family income of 175 to 200% of the state's poverty level. And others are pending that would allow parents who earn more than double the poverty level to purchase the coverage. The increased level would add 1,300 children to the rolls. Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra, who has sponsored another bill, says the copay element would make health care available to another 10,000 children. He says right now the government provides medical insurance for people who aren't working, and some people get coverage as a job benefit.
We don't provide the medical coverage needed to children of people who work who can't afford medical coverage, right? And this isn't an issue of giving out welfare benefits. This is an issue of helping people get medical care for their children because the people they work with don't offer health insurance. For very little money, we could allow families to buy into the Denali Kid Care program, and every child in the state could, for very little money, have health insurance.
Wasilla Republican Wes Keller is chair of the House Health and Social Services Committee and has two of the bills under consideration. He says he anticipates one of them passing this session. The House Transportation Committee made a three-village tour of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta this week. Six legislators traveled with transportation officials to assess the needs in rural Alaska. KYUK's Shane Iverson traveled along and has this story.
The tour began in typical fashion, with the delay caused by fog. By the time lawmakers got to the village of Kipnuk, coastal showers began to fall. Kipnuk resident and tribal vice president Thomas Hanley told the entourage that heavy amounts of rain can be a serious problem for their runway.
In the springtime, you have to land on the runway and get off and walk through mud up over your ankles. It's caused from the airplanes turning around. It's insufficient room for the airplanes to turn around, and it causes grooves, and they fill up with water.
Mud was a major theme in Kipnuk. The cold forced the group into the best building in town, the village school. There, lawmakers and policymakers spoke with residents about transportation issues in their community. Behind the school is one of Kipnuk's most important roads. It's skinny, made almost entirely of mud, and riddled with puddles. Tribal President Paul J. Paul highlighted the problem to Deputy Aviation Commissioner Christine Klein.
Forklift sunk over here.
Oh, yes.
All this right there is real deep.
Okay, that's where the forklift got stuck.
Yeah.
Okay.
We really need some help over here.
So now, ma'am. I suppose there's no big rocks or anything that you can put in there.
This is mud area, swamp area.
Anchorage Representative Mike Dugan says trips like these are helpful for lawmakers and policymakers to really comprehend the differing circumstances in rural Alaska.
There's nothing like seeing something with your own eyes, because some of these folks I've seen down in Juneau, they come and say, you know, this is what we're looking for. But you just, at least I'm not good at looking at maps and visualizing, so I'd like to be able to see things with my own eyes.
Inside the school, as students and teachers crowded the halls, discussion broadened into several topics.
So you come out here to look at the look at the airport, and the next thing you know, you're talking about the boardwalks and the streets and then the schools, because it's all one thing, right? It's all, you know, how much money you got and what you're going to try and do with it.
Plans are in place to build a new airport in Kipnuk, but the process takes years. The gravel base of the runway must be given time to settle before any other construction can start. Lawmakers got a chance to see a new runway in the tundra village of Nunapichuk. There, a much wider and much longer runway with fresh gravel made for a welcome landing strip when the group arrived in their small planes. But even with the new runway, the village still has its challenges. For one, the runway is on a strip of land separated from the village by waterways. Moses Brink is at a small dock at the end of the runway, piling boxes of food items into his 14-foot skiff. For 20 years, Brink has worked bringing bypass mail to the village, one boatload at a time.
And it's a lot of hard work.
Representative Bob Heron represents a large portion of the Kuskokwim region. He invited the group for the tour. Any capital project in rural Alaska comes with a big price tag. Heron says these legislators may be less likely to shy away from such projects if they see how important they are to the villages in need.
The things that we need out here, basic needs. I mean, we're not asking for Taj Mahals. We're not asking expensive things. We're asking for basic services.
At least one more legislative committee is planning on coming to the YK Delta. On October 12th, the Natural Resources Committee will hold a hearing in Bethel. Much of the discussion is expected to hinge on salmon issues and the Bering Sea pollock fisheries. I'm Shane Iverson.
Back in Anchorage today, the House Transportation Committee members reviewed their trip with Department of Transportation officials. Deputy Commissioner Christine Klein told the panel that they had seen three of the 258 state-owned airports and more than 700 federally recognized airports in Alaska. She said they also need to see the aviation system from the 30,000-foot level.
We are the largest aviation system in the United States, as well as larger than the Russian Federation of Airports, which when you think of that, that's a pretty massive system for such a large state but small population.
Alaska received $78 million, or 7%, of the aviation stimulus money this year. That's drawn national attention, which she says doesn't recognize the role of aviation here.
Some of our small communities are so small, and you've probably heard of our Ozinki and our Atikotna and Yakutchak. But that is the only access in and out of those communities. It is the only way to get in and out. And so one of the issues that I think you're going to hear in the future, and if you haven't already, is that our small airports are very, very important to the state, even if it is a small population and small community.
The committee will use information from the trip in determining transportation policy during next year's legislative session. Hundred 130 young walrus found dead on Alaska's North Shore were likely trampled to death by adult animals. The grim scene was discovered last month by biologists hoping to deploy satellite tags on walrus that hauled out in Alaska after their sea ice habitat in the Chukchi Sea disappeared. A team that investigated the deaths released its preliminary report today. APRN's Annie Feit has the story.
The walrus carcasses were scattered across a wide sandy beach at Icy Cape on the Chukchi Sea coast between Barrow and Wainwright. Almost all of them were calves. The investigation team included a veterinarian from the Alaska Sea Life Center, hunters from Barrow and Wainwright, and biologist Robert Sudam, who works for the North Slope Borough. He says several signs strongly indicated trampling as the cause of death.
The general findings from the necropsies, the detailed necropsies, showed that there was bruising in the throat and chest regions. And in one case, one animal had a broken skull and another animal had a broken rib. So all of that information suggested that it was trampling.
The calves and yearlings were likely part of a group of at least 2,000 walrus that hauled out at Icy Cape in August. They came to shore as the Chukchi Sea ice disappeared in one of the largest Arctic ice retreat years on record. When a herd is spooked, animals begin stampeding into the water. Adults can weigh more than 4,000 pounds and will easily crush smaller animals in the rush to enter the sea. Jeff York is a former USGS biologist who now works for the World Wildlife Fund. He says the walrus are much more vulnerable on land than they would be during a normal ice year at sea.
to me personally, that's the real point here, is that if we had the sea ice in the Chukchi Sea that we would normally have had this time of year, those animals wouldn't have been on shore. They would have been out on the sea ice feeding, and those calves would probably still be alive today.
This summer, York was on a yacht that traversed Russia's vast coastline along the Northeast Passage. On that trip, he witnessed trampling deaths firsthand at a haul-out of 20,000 walrus on the Chukotka coast.
We saw and have footage from that trip of animals tumbling down steep slopes and not moving. And we also know from our Chukchi partners on the ground from past years that we've had fairly high mortality rates some years at those haul-out sites.
The North Slope Borough is asking subsistence hunters for samples of walrus so biologists can track the health of the species. Robert Sudam says so far, the samples haven't revealed any obviously alarming signs that the animals are stressed, but some observations tell a different story.
We have been seeing walrus that are very tired, that have apparently been swimming a long distance and haul out on shore and want to rest for long periods of time. So the changing ice patterns makes us very concerned about the future of walrus populations and the ability for people to be able to continue to hunt them.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is currently considering adding walrus to the endangered species list. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a member of the Alaska Territorial Guard dies.
Well, he was a really good father, and we're going to miss him.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com.
One of the fishermen involved in the Marshall protest fishery was issued a citation. The person cited is a tribal president and the only police safety officer in the village. Jason Isaac was cited yesterday by enforcement officers with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. On June 26th, about six boats filled with 18 fishermen put their nets in the water and caught about 100 king salmon. At the time, subsistence users could only fish two 18-hour periods each week set by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Nick Andrew is executive director of the tribe in Marshall. Some have called the fishery a protest, but Andrew says it was a matter of necessity.
We had our elders in the village facing low food security. We also had the widows. We did have our disabled who would face the winter with basically chum and silver salmon in their freezers.
Andrew says the citation will not deter a similar protest in the future if his village is up against hard times and tight fishing restrictions.
We cannot allow our subsistence way of life to be compromised at all costs, especially at the hands of big business and or an unsympathetic state government.
Like many subsistence users, Andrew says that village families are being unfairly targeted while the pollock fleet in the Bering Sea is allowed to waste up to hundreds of thousands of salmon as bycatch. The citation calls for Isaac to pay $275 and appear in court. The Fish and Wildlife Service says it doesn't comment on ongoing investigations. Alaska senators took to the floor today to call on the Obama administration to support restoring retirement benefits to men who were in the Alaska Territorial Guard during World War II. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski said the president should, quote, show some heart and do the right thing.
I would ask that President Obama personally support us in our quest to obtain justice for a few elderly Alaska Natives who once served our nation with patriotism, with pride, and with distinction.
Murkowski says President Obama may not even personally know of the situation. Earlier this year, Alaska's delegation sent him a letter asking for his support. But instead, last week, the Obama administration made recommendations for the defense spending bill now before Congress. It weighed in against giving the Guardsmen benefits, saying their wartime service counted as state employment and did not qualify for military pensions. Alaska was a territory at the time, and Murkowski says the Alaska Native men were serving the United States.
These were Uncle Sam's men. All who served were volunteers. They were not state employees. It was organized in the name of the President of the United States. It was armed by the United States Army. The operations of the units were inspected by the U.S. Army. The unit was disbanded in 1947 by order of the United States Army.
Democratic Senator Mark Begich says they were defending the nation against the Japanese. Begich said on the Senate floor today that he doesn't want to see a delay. Currently, the state is paying the benefits, but that will run out in February.
These brave Alaskans are now in their 70s and 80s. Just this past Monday, one of them, Nikolai Nikolai of Kwikluk, passed away before he could see this issue resolved.
Nikolai was 88 years old. KMBA's Jennifer Canfield spoke with his son and has their story.
He was born in Kanak. Both of his parents died when he was young, so Nikolai was raised in the Moravian Children's Home. He met his wife, Xenia, when she and her family would visit the children's home during holidays. Nikolai and his wife had a total of 18 children. 9 died from sickness when they were young. The other 9 are still living. Nikolai's oldest son, Patrick, says that his father never really spoke about his 22 years of military service, including his time in the Alaska Territorial Guard. It says he spent his time after the military as a janitor for the Bureau of Indian Affairs and was a very active subsistence hunter.
They were really active about subsistence back then. There's spring camps, summer camps, and fall camps. They go to back then, but nowadays they're mostly stationary in the village.
Patrick says that his father's best friend, Michael Ivan, died about 50 years ago. Ivan was also a Territorial Guard member. Nikolai's wife, Xenia, didn't want to talk, but Patrick gave insight as to how his mother's coping with the death.
She don't want to say anything. She's very emotional about it. She's talking like, miss them already. They've been together for a long time.
In the days leading up to Nikolai's passing, Patrick had been thinking about his father's life. He called his father a teacher and a role model. Patrick says he wants to emulate his father's good deeds.
It's what I want to be when I get ready to go. He made me feel that way.
22 years in the military, and not even his family had much to say about it. It seemed as though it were a footnote in a life steeped in tradition and kept busy with family.
Well, he was a really good father, and we're going to miss him.
Nikolai was buried in Kwikluk, in Anchorage. I'm Jennifer Canfield.
This week, the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals reversed an earlier decision in a lawsuit brought by the Arctic Slope Native Association and the Metlakatla Indian Community against the Indian Health Service for lack of full payment of contract support for medical services. Tribes and Native organizations contract with the Department of Health and Social Services to run IHS facilities in Barrow and Metlakatla. Attorney Lloyd Miller has successfully handled similar cases nationally for the Cherokee Nation and the Pueblo of Zuni. Miller says the federal government contracts with the tribes to run federal facilities, but then deeply underfunds the contracts.
It's really a shocking thing that never happens in any other area of federal procurement law. Doesn't happen in the defense industry, nowhere else. But it happens when tribes are on the other side of the contract. There was litigation, which I handled, that went to the United States Supreme Court, which held that the government couldn't do it. The government was responsible for fully paying these contracts, and if it didn't, it could be sued and would answer in damages.
The appeal was brought by the Alaska Native organizations after the Civilian Board of Contract Appeals dismissed their claims on the grounds that they had not been filed within 6 years and the statute of limitations had run out. The litigants argued that because tribes in the lower 48 have a class action suit that started in the mid-1990s against the IHS for lack of payment, the clock was automatically stopped on the statute. Miller says the appeals court wrote that didn't apply because the federal government has special protection in these types of claims.
But that having been said, the court said that doesn't matter. There's another way in which late claims can proceed forward, and that's based on the rule of equitable tolling, which requires a judge to assess whether, considering the equities to the government and the equities to the contractor, the delay is acceptable and doesn't prejudice the government.
which means the decision is ultimately mixed. The cases cannot automatically proceed based on the class action precedent. They will have to convince the Civilian Board of Contract Appeals of the equities of their cases in order for them to move forward. Marie Carroll is the president and CEO of the Arctic Slope Native Association. Although it's unclear how much money will ultimately be awarded should ASNA prevail, it will be several million dollars. Carroll says that would help a lot because currently Barrow's four-decade-old hospital can only handle basic medical care.
For instance, we've replaced a nursing station that was being kept up with duct tape, and we finally replaced that after several years. Things like that go on.
A similar contract case successfully brought against the IHS by the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation resulted in a settlement for YKHC of more than $40 million.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. Tech Alaska, operators of the Red Dog Mine in Northwest Alaska, delivering jobs and revenues to Alaska for 20 years and now working on the next 20 years. Online at reddogalaska.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan is worried about natural gas shortages that could affect the city during coming winters. Sullivan says South Central Alaska's economy is built on natural gas and that Anchorage's 40-year growth has literally been fueled by natural gas. Natural gas provides the base fuel for 85 to 90% of the kilowatt hours produced by area electrical utilities. Sullivan says this winter there is enough gas to provide for city needs, but dwindling Cook Inlet gas supplies could create a shortage in the future.
As the gas fields age and the pressure declines, we know that's a continuing and growing problem. So the producers and NSTAR over the years have added compressors to help maintain pressure in the system. Even though a disruption isn't considered likely, preparing for a potential gas delivery problem really is just good public policy.
Sullivan has created long and short-term task forces to deal with the possibility of future gas disruptions. This week, he met with Rail Belt utilities managers and city officials to outline how the public will be asked to respond to the energy situation in case a crisis occurs.
Customers are going to be asked to do a fairly simple thing for the most part, things we can all do, like turning down our thermostats, turning off unnecessary lights and electronics, postponing doing laundry or dishes, and it was amazing to me that somebody explained to me that if on a given day everybody just didn't do their wash that day, incredible amount of load is taken off the system.
Although utility managers already keep in close contact with one another regarding energy interruptions, Sullivan has outlined a plan to both alert and include the public in dealing with shortages. Three steps, stable, caution, and alert, will be used to monitor energy availability, and customers will be asked to respond to each by setting thermostats lower, reducing the temperature on hot water heaters, and in the worst cases, consolidating living activities to a few rooms to conserve heat. Sullivan says the city is initiating a media campaign to alert the public to the emergency system. He says later this month, the city will conduct a test exercise, asking communities to curtail energy consumption to see how much energy can be saved by homeowners. Sullivan says short-term power outages will only be used by the electric companies as a last resort. Deliveries to Sitka's recycling program have dropped for the first time since the inception of the program in 2003. The decline in recyclables in the second quarter of this year closely tracks the decline in sales tax revenues the city finance department reported for the same period. Both figures are down about 15% from last year. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Norm Campbell is the coordinator of Recycle Sitka.
We've seen a drop in the actual amount that we're collecting. Through August, it was only about 5 tons a month, but always in the past 4 years, we've always been on that upward tack that we've been looking for.
Sitkin's dropped off 114 tons of corrugated cardboard in the second quarter of 2008, but only 98 tons in the second quarter of 2009. Mixed paper dropped from 52 tons to 42. Newsprint was down 45%, and tin cans actually ticked up from just under 3 tons to just under 4. The overall drop would be a bigger problem for Recycle Sitka if the market for commodities still resembled 2008. Campbell says that the crash in the price of recycled materials appears to be over.
Corrugated cardboard went from $120 a ton to $55 a ton, and that's a substantial drop. And it's climbing back up now. The last time I checked, it was 88, I think.
Campbell says the recycling program tips toward profitability the closer the price for corrugated cardboard moves toward the $120 mark. With aluminum recycling under the management of the Baranoff Barracuda Swim Club, cardboard is the main financial driver for Sitka's recycling program, but Campbell says that could change. The program will relocate from the Marine Services Center to the former incinerator site on Jeff Davis Street once the city purchase of the property is finalized. Campbell says the most obvious change people will notice is a much larger capacity for handling plastics, which have remained a valuable recyclable over the year. Also, the move to a new location may provide an opportunity to move into a new and potentially lucrative material.
Office paper, which is a high worth product, the last time I checked, $440 a ton. And we're just mixing it in with our mixed paper and reducing its value to the mid-30s. So in the future, that's one of the goals, is to figure out how we can, without a lot of problems, start capturing that valuable office paper.
Campbell says mixed paper is selling at about $38 a ton, which doesn't even cover the cost of handling. Campbell does not expect the dip in recycling numbers to turn around immediately. Typically, summer is the highest volume season for the program, but autumn is far cleaner, with much less contamination in the bins. Serious recyclers, Campbell says, are out there in the rain and the wind. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And finally tonight, we have a correction. In a story from Juneau yesterday regarding a proposed tobacco tax, we reported the rise in the tax on tobacco products other than cigarettes would be an increase of 12%. The correct figure is an increase of 45%. Our apologies for the error. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Jennifer Canfield in Anchorage, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. Litsite Alaska is a web community for families, teachers, librarians, health professionals, and Alaskans of all ages. There are thousands of pages with everything from Alaska's digital archives to kids' games, information about the state's history, culture, narrative, and healing. Teachers love Litsite Alaska. You can discover Litsite Alaska at LITSITE.org. Litsite Alaska is a project of the University of Alaska Anchorage. This message sponsored by UAA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.